there was either pilot error or something wrong with the plane. What you're saying is absolutely true, however. Cuba has a fleet of aging planes simply because they cannot buy new planes that either are made in the United States or contain parts that are made in the United States. And most jet planes today have parts that were made in the United States. It's a brutal blockade that's been imposed by the United States against Cuba since 1961. And that results in tragedy, lack of medicine sometimes, lack of plane parts. This tragedy probably stems from that. And Cuba's doing everything in its power right now to investigate what happened. Two survivors are in critical condition. The prognosis is not good for one of them. And Cuba, I'm sure, will try to prevent this from happening again. But the best way for the United States to respond is not to give prayers and condolences, but to lift the embargo and allow Cuba to purchase planes with American parts and fly safely over Cuban skies.
Jose Percheri, I want to thank you for being with us. Cuban attorney based in Washington, D.C., represented the Venezuelan government in efforts to extradite Luis Posada Carriles, who died on Wednesday, a free man in Miami. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Nermin Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Nat Needham, and Libby Rainey. On Monday, 1968, 50-year look back special from Catonsville to the My Lai massacre to the Columbia student strikes to the King assassination. Tune in. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:01. Coming up next is your Friday evening news, but first.
We're celebrating KBOO's 50th anniversary on June 3rd at 2 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society's Outdoor Plaza. Join us for music, fun, special guests, and bring a homemade birthday cake to share and help us celebrate. Bike to the party as part of our Pedal Palooza bike ride. The ride begins at 1 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8. Come ride your bike from our building to former locations of the radio station and end at the celebratory 50th anniversary of the very day we first switched on our transmitter and began broadcasting to and with the communities of Portland. Again, that's our 50th birthday party on Sunday, June 3rd at 2 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on the party and our history can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
Happy birthday! Happy birthday!
KBOO Community Radio is proud co-sponsor of the Vanport Mosaic Festival, a four-day multidisciplinary event from May 23rd to May 28th in various venues in North and Northeast Portland. The Vanport Mosaic Festival includes exhibits, art performances, a reunion and celebration of former Vanport residents, oral history documentary screenings of Priced Out and Lost City, Living Memories, and tours of the historic Vanport City. Again, that's the Vanport Mosaic Festival, a four-day multidisciplinary event from May 23rd to May 28th. Taking place in various venues in North and Northeast Portland. More information about the festival, including specific performances, screenings, dates, times, and venues, can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hey, guess what? It's time for the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a hit-and-run incident on the campus of Portland State University has left at least three people injured. The driver is in custody.
Volunteers at the Audubon Society of Portland are upset at the Society's plans to remove a 10-year-old raven from the Education Bird program there.
And we'll continue to take stock of the impact of the Max attack 1 year later.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 25th, 2018. I'm Ruben Lawrence.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlin. Late this morning, multiple pedestrians were struck by a SUV on the PSU campus downtown. The car reportedly jumped the curb and ran down at least three people, all identified as women, and may have aimed for others before speeding off with noticeable damage to its hood. The suspected driver was arrested in the early afternoon near Benson High School, and police say there is no longer any threat to the public. Speculation is swirling on social media about the motivations of the driver, which are still not definitively known at this time. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman was at the scene soon after the hit and run and has this report.
Just before 11 a.m., police and first responders were still mapping out the scene of the hit and run.
If I get your attention for just a minute, we're going to move this crime scene back up to Broadway.
Several dozen people milled around, talking and craning their necks to see the scene of the crash. A bloody sweatshirt still lay on the bricks of the PSU Urban Center at Southwest 6th and Montgomery. A woman being interviewed by multiple TV news reporters stated that while she did not see the incident unfold, she witnessed the immediate aftermath, having been drawn by the sound of people screaming. At a press conference held at 11:15 a.m., Sergeant Chris Burley, the Bureau's public information officer, described the situation of the victims at the time.
Emergency medical responders provided the women medical aid and transported them to an area hospital by ambulances. At this time, it is believed that two of the women are suffering from what appear to be serious life-threatening injuries. One of the women is believed to have serious, but at this time not believed to be life-threatening injuries. We're still in the very early stages of this incident. What we do know at this time is that the three women were located or were walking on the east sidewalk of Southwest 6th Avenue between Southwest Harrison and Southwest Montgomery Street when they were struck by the vehicle.
As of 2 p.m. this afternoon, only one of the women was still in critical condition, though all three were still hospitalized. A blue Mazda Tribute was photographed by witnesses and security cameras leaving the scene of the hit-and-run and was later stopped by police at Northeast 16th and Gleason. Helicopter footage from KATU News shows a man being taken into custody surrounded by several cop cars. The Oregonian newspaper quotes a police source who says the registered owner of the Mazda Tribute is a older white man and has been flagged by the Bureau as, quote, suicidal with mental health issues, unquote. Based on witness statements, police believe that the hit-and-run was intentional, but say there is no remaining threat to the public since the man was apprehended. The FBI has confirmed it is on the scene downtown, assisting local detectives. The areas around 6th and Montgomery downtown and Northeast 16th and Gleason were closed off for much of the afternoon due to police activity. For KBOO Evening News in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
The Audubon Society of Portland is one of the area's premier organizations devoted to wildlife conservation and education, with a focus on birds and their habitats. But now, volunteers are expressing concern about the Society's plans for one of its longtime education birds, according to a whistleblower who spoke to KBOO on conditions of anonymity. Audubon's education staff recently decided to move Aristophanes, a 10-year-old raven, to a smaller site in Texas. The whistleblower, a volunteer who has worked with the education birds, says that the staff repeatedly ignored suggestions from volunteers for how to keep Aristophanes from, quote, acting out. They also say that the decision does not have the support of all staff or the education bird handler volunteers. Volunteers, including the whistleblower we spoke to, fear that the transfer of Aristophanes is part of a pattern of behavior intending to alienate longtime volunteers and change the nature of the educational bird program from volunteer to staff only. Already, they say, the current head of the education department has stopped running decisions past the long-standing volunteer council. The worry among volunteers is that the internal struggles at Audubon will negatively affect the health of the birds.
The whistleblower says that Aristophanes already is reacting negatively to a limited diet, including identifiable stress marks on its plumage. Ravens, according to the Audubon Society's own website, are known for their, quote, intelligence and complex social dynamics, end quote. Aristophanes arrived at the Audubon after being illegally hand-raised by humans for the first weeks of his life and subsequently developed a strong attachment to his volunteer handlers, even when they tried to release him to a group of established wild ravens his own age. Volunteers worry that such a change will be detrimental to a creature as intelligent as Aristophanes, with such a close bond to specific volunteer handlers. A nationally known bird behavior expert, Bernard Heinrich of the University of Vermont, has even written to the head of the Society's educational program to express his disapproval for the move. A former Audubon volunteer and current KABU volunteer, Michelle Bolin, describes interacting with Aristophanes in the years after he arrived.
When he sees you, he'll make noises or gestures. A lot of the times, if you're standing outside his mew, he'll like throw a piece of rock or maybe a piece of wood to you and acknowledge you. He does have friends that are ravens, that are wild ravens, and they come visit his mew. And they'll play with him and throw things to him. Sometimes they'll bring him food.
And you said he'll, like, say hi to you?
Well, technically they say he doesn't say hi, but he'll go, hi, which pretty clearly is a hi. And I've heard him kind of bark like a dog occasionally. He's a character. He has a lot of volunteers who've worked with him over his 10 years and have developed great relationships with him.
According to the whistleblower, it has not been made clear when Aristophanes will be moved, and despite opposition and distress over the decision from some staff and many volunteers, the education staff is, quote, dug in deep and ready for a fight, end quote.
Queens is a film that shows viewers one slice of the lives that transgender individuals live. In this case, the world of competitions leading to the ultimate crown. KABU's Zelos Marchant has more on this.
Stand by on blacks.
There is nothing better.
It's like winning an Oscar.
Ladies, we're going to start going up.
I've always wished last. I dream about it.
No one knows where this match is going tonight, honey. Absolutely no one. It is anybody's game.
Proudly represent Miss Europe Continental.
All the way from Canada.
Melbourne, Australia.
Bangkok, Thailand.
Miss Caribbean Continental.
Go, 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 go.
Trying to come here and walk away without it.
They've come year after year, and they've come 6, 7, 10 years competing at this pageant.
Those girls are tearing it up. There's really only a few points between all of the contestants.
I have Mark Saxonmeyer, the director of Queens, on the line.
Yes.
In Minneapolis. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing pretty fantastic. Thank you for directing this awesome film. Tell us about it.
It's my pleasure. I was very proud and excited to bring this world to film.
Us too. I can say I am. Well, take our listeners through a brief synopsis of what the film's about to those who do not know about the world of Queens.
I would say, it's part Paris is Burning, and that is a cult film from the early 90s, which I fell in love with when it was first released, and it deals with the balls of New York City. And when it first came out, I was fascinated by this whole world of drag queens and transgender individuals performing in these houses. And it inspired me way back then, and I thought one day I would like to make a movie like that. And it's part RuPaul's Drag Race, which of course is a big part of the culture now, a big cult phenomenon. It was moved from Logo to VH1. It's in its 10th, 11th season. And then the other part, I would say, is part Miss America, because we chronicle a transgender beauty pageant. So it's a look into the transgender subculture of competitive female impersonation. And I emphasize subculture because by no means does it seek to represent everyone in the transgender community. It's simply a sliver of transgender life that we have brought to film because the mission of our production company, The Reporters, Inc., is to focus on subject matter that's underrepresented, misrepresented, avoided, or ignored by mainstream media.
Well, you just crossed all those T's and dotted the I's about misrepresentation, no representation, all that.
Yeah, I mean, I was a TV reporter for years, and I was always frustrated the kinds of stories that I wished could be covered or would be covered and just weren't covered. Mm-hmm. So when I formed the Reporters, Inc., you know, our goal is to do those stories.
That's fantastic. Do you have a singular favorite part of the film, or more than one favorite part of the film?
Oh, gosh. That's like asking me to pick that favorite child, right?
I know. I totally got you a hard question.
I would say that, for me, the fact that the contestants in this particular beauty pageant really want this crown. This is a lifelong dream and a lifelong goal. And when it is denied, you know how pageants go, they narrow it down to the top 12 and the top 5. You know, we're behind the scenes showing the emotion and the heartache and the fact that they had worked so hard and so long to try to win this title. And it's devastating, especially because a lot of them spent a lot of money to win this title, too. So I think, you know, that is what the film does well. It takes you behind the scenes. It's an unvarnished look at the goals and aspirations of these folks, and really when their dreams are dashed, how painful it is. And you know, we don't glorify the pain, but we present it so people understand this means something to them. This is a goal they've worked for their whole lives, and like I say, when it's done and it's over, it's very painful.
That led into my next question: what does the crown mean in these competitions?
Yeah, you know, that was like kind of the ultimate question I asked almost everyone who appears in the film. Because if you're involved in this pageant world of the transgender lifestyle, you know, it's everyone knows about it. People who vie for the crown of Miss Continental all know about it. It's well known. There are DVDs of every year of the contest going back to 1980. It's the first pageant of its kind that allowed transgender competitors to compete. But again, outside this world, nobody's heard of it. So I would say to some of the folks, you know, no one's heard of this. Like, what is it? Why does it matter if you win something that no one's heard of? And the answer constantly was, this matters to us. This matters to our world. And to win this crown, their asking price goes up when they go on tour, when they perform in bars and nightclubs around the world. They gain notoriety. They gain a fan base. It's just like any entertainer wants notoriety. They want their career to blossom and flourish via more fans, which ultimately means more money. So I guess that's the long and short of it.
Tell our listeners where they can catch the show here in Portland.
Oh, it's showing at the iconic Hollywood Theater. Have you been?
Yes.
I have not, and I'm really excited to go because I've heard and read so much about it. I mean, that theater emphasizes independent and nonprofit film, and that is who we are, and they were very excited to be a showcase for us, and it'll be our first screening on the West Coast. We're going to Seattle on June 7th as well.
Oh, we're totally honored then. We're the first Northwest stop.
There you go.
Fantastic.
I couldn't be thrilled because we're showing it for the first time in digital on a huge screen. We've only shown it in smaller venues up to this point. So I'm excited to see it on the big screen for the first time. And, you know, our goal is we're also entering film festivals with it, and we're reaching out to distributors and networks and groups like Netflix and Hulu and Netflix and HBO and some other organizations to hopefully get it picked up and receive widespread distribution. But for now, we're kind of going city to city and showing it to the folks who are most interested in the subject matter.
Well, awesome. I've been talking with Mark Saxonmeier, the director of Queens. It's showing at the Hollywood Theater this Monday, 7:30. Don't miss it.
It's a great way to spend your Memorial Day.
That's right. Thank you, Mark, so much for taking time to talk to me.
Thank you guys for helping spread the word. I hope people come out.
This is Zelos Marchant for KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned at 5:30 for Counterspin, a production of the Center for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. At 6, it's Bread and Roses. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be a low of 47 with 20% chance of rain. Tomorrow will be a little colder than today with a high of 66 and a 20% chance of rain. Today in history was a good day for hand sanitizer manufacturers, with Hands Across America occurring on this day in 1986, in which 6.5 million people formed a human chain from New York to Long Beach. Also on this day in 1977, the Chinese government removed its ban on the works of William Shakespeare as part of a final dismantling of the decades-plus Cultural Revolution. And today in history, the people of the Republic of Ireland voted to repeal its constitutional ban on abortion. The quote of the day is from Martinican writer, physician, and activist Frantz Fanon, who said, "The unemployed and the starving do not lay claim to truth. They do not say they represent the truth because they are the truth in their very being," end quote.
Sadly, the cancellation of the denuclearization talks between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un came as a surprise to almost no one. KBOO's Ray Bodwell thinks this is just another glaring example of the overall incompetence of the current administration.
Critics of the Trump administration repeatedly point to abandonment of our allies, catering to the wealthy, and widespread corruption as its chief failings. But I think when history is written, its incredible incompetence will be what historians focus on. It runs throughout the administration, as regularly evidenced by the mindless and frequently contradictory statements of Trump's staff and cabinet members, as well as the president himself. The cancellation of the June 12th summit between Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is just the latest example. Earlier this week, National Security Advisor John Bolton and Vice President Mike Pence pushed themselves towards the top of the stupidity leaderboard with comments about North Korea's possible future. Bolton started it off by saying that the denuclearization of North Korea would be similar to what happened when Libyan dictator Muammar al-Qaddafi gave up his nuclear program in 2003. That remark was followed by this statement by Pence during an interview with Fox News on Monday evening.
You know, there was some talk about the Libyan model last week, and as the president made clear, this will only end like the Libyan model ended if Kim Jong-un doesn't make a deal.
These comments were certainly not going to provide any reassurance to North Korean leader Kim. As he well knows, Qaddafi gave up his nuclear program and was killed by NATO-backed rebel forces 8 years later. Whether both Pence and Bolton failed their history or their psychology classes is unknown, but the Kim regime's response to these two thinly veiled threats was predictable. A senior member of the North Korean Foreign Ministry referred to Pence as, quote, a political dummy, end quote, and called his comments, quote, unbridled and impudent. On Thursday, citing tremendous anger and hostility from the North Koreans, Trump canceled the meeting in a bizarrely worded letter to the North Korean leader, whom he addressed as His Excellency. Then, sounding like it was simply a real estate deal gone bad, rather than a potential lead-up to a nuclear confrontation, he thanked Kim for his, quote, time, patience, and effort, end quote. I'm certainly not an apologist for the Kim regime. He's clearly a dangerous despot, and you have to feel sorry for the citizens of the Hermit Kingdom. But considering that his country may have lost as much as 30% of its population and most of its infrastructure during the Korean War, a war which is still technically going on, and bearing in mind that multiple U.S. administrations have called for regime change, you can see why Kim would be more than a little paranoid. On top of that, earlier this month, the U.S. walked away from the Iran deal, demonstrating to the entire world that we can't be trusted to live up to our agreements. Couple all these facts together with a wide range of conflicting signals coming out of the administration, as well as Trump's history of threatening fire and fury on the little rocket man, and it's no surprise that the talks have fallen apart. I certainly can't speak for the Kim regime, but the Trump regime is clearly staffed by a bunch of incompetents who are incapable of understanding the global impact of their words and actions. and it appears that once again, our self-proclaimed dealmaker-in-chief has failed to close the deal. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
And you're correctly, I didn't.
Tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary of the stabbings on a MAX train that left two people dead and another seriously injured. The attacks began when a man verbally attacked and threatened two young women of color with racist and anti-Muslim slurs. KBOO reporter Tom Flynn spent much of the time in the aftermath of the murders speaking to Portlanders about their reactions to it and charting the changes at the Hollywood Transit Center where the attack occurred. Today, Tom hosts part two of a look back at that incident that shook the city.
A day in May, the Hollywood murders. This is the second of two episodes in which KBOO News revisits the events of May 25th, 2017. It's now May 2018, a year later, and we remember that day in order to understand how those murders fit in the history of the city and how they'll affect its future. Today we speak with two social activists who've been observing race relations in Portland for decades. Scott Nakagawa is a consultant with Change Lab, a Seattle-based organization that works nationally on community health and justice. Eric Ward is executive director of Western States, an organization that works with communities on social justice issues. But we start by hearing the city's agenda, what it's done in the past year, and what it's planning for the future. Here's Linda Castillo of the city's Office of Neighborhood Involvement. Has this incident had a permanent effect on the city?
The city set aside $350,000 to develop and support programming to support victims of hate crimes and microaggressions. 13 organizations were selected.
What about the TriMet? Has TriMet responded?
The only changes we've seen with TriMet is that they have increased their police presence at the different platforms. And for our communities, that hasn't necessarily been where they felt safer. They've actually felt more threatened.
What about the Portland Police Department? Have they changed in any way their approach towards this kind of crime or how they handle things?
I think that's a conversation we have yet to have. All the jurisdictions of the police bureau, of the city, of the county, with the sheriff, with the transit police and TriMet, that's a conversation that needs to happen.
Is there a permanent memorial in existence or planned?
Yeah, my understanding is that an artist was selected. The official unveiling is going to take place on the 26th of May.
Linda Castillo, thank you for joining us today on KBOO.
You're welcome.
We go next to Scott Nakagawa. He tells us about what he's been doing on what he calls the white nationalist insurgency here.
You know, I've been doing national work on this issue for a very long time, going all the way back to the 80s.
Have things improved?
The environment has not improved. The environment feels to some people like it has because what we have now is greater polarization. The two sides have, you know, articulated positions that are clearer to us, more legible to us. But no, things have gotten actually, I think, quite a bit worse.
In what ways have they gotten worse?
Well, I think what we have here is a much more deeply entrenched white nationalist right. We have more investment and interest in Oregon on the part of the white nationalist movement nationally.
Has the city taken appropriate action?
I think the city's mayor has actually made some really powerful statements that have taken us to a different place than we were in the time of the 80s that I talked about, in that what he has basically said is that this isn't just a problem of hate, that this is a structural problem. Portland is a city in a state that trails the country on every major indicator of racial equity and by significant margins, and yet has convinced itself that it is the most progressive of cities in the country.
What's on the agenda for the future? Will there be more specific ways to deal with the situation? Or is it the structural problem that is too big to get our brains around?
Well, that structural problem is not as complicated as people like to think. if it's, you want to grapple with something complicated, reach into your pocket and pull out your cell phone. That's a complicated thing that took millions and millions of dollars of government investment through the U.S. military in part and private capital to develop that thing that can do all of those things in this tiny little object that fits in your pocket. That's the kind of innovation and invention that we're capable of. But on the issue of race, we don't make that kind of progress.
What should we be doing?
For the KABU audience, I think we need to consider this. We are a progressive city. In spite of that, we continue to be behind the ball on racial equity. We are not where the rest of the country is on average. And so that story about who we are as a progressive community has a giant gap in it. And it is through that gap that these people have decided that Oregon is the land of the future. Because what they see is something that Eric Ward, who is a friend of mine, likes to say, that under liberal government here, we are accomplishing what white nationalists could only dream of. The city grows ever whiter. Circumstances for people of color here grow ever greater.
Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And here's Scott Ward to explore that contradiction. Has there been any permanent effect of this incident?
I think the events of last year were a measure of just simply how bad things had gotten. What we know is that hate crimes still continue. But the real impact of last year was that it created a chill in the air for a city that has always struggled around diversity and equity. When we think of these two young Black women who are forever scarred, when we think of that, it's heartbreaking. But what's inspiring is that these three white men who didn't even know each other, didn't know these women, stood up for their neighbor. These are heroes. And that type of heroics actually is also a history within Oregon.
Do you feel that the responses to the incident on the part of the city and the Portland Police Bureau and the TriMet, that those have been appropriate?
The city of Portland and its leadership stepped up in a way that I haven't seen in many other cities across the country. The mayor did a phenomenal job.